To sever your mother from her space-time requires the energy equivalent of a supernova. But we do have another massive source of exotic energy.
The dark matter particles.
We may be able to modify a transporter enhancer with dark matter.
Yes, to pierce the time stream long enough to lock on Dr. Burnham and beam her into our space-time. Permanently. I like science.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, trying to negotiate a better contract with an incumbent actor and having a lot of difficulty and maybe putting some feelers out there to the rest of Hollywood about who might want to replace this person.
That's a very technical opening.
Yes.
But let's talk about the weirdest and wildest Star Trek alternate actors.
Yeah, so, Cam, look, we have our typical actors, the ones that have originated the roles, though. But every once in a while,
your Shatners, your Patrick Stewarts,
But every once in a while, you know, you need to kind of cast a different actor, whether you're playing like the child version of a character, or look, you're starting a Kelvinverse, or maybe you're going back in time to maybe the Discovery era. You're going to get new faces involved. It's just like a matter of practicality here.
Sometimes you need a hand double.
Well, that's how I paid my way through university. I was a hand model. It was beautiful until I had like this horrible accident with an iron. But Cam, I think when we're talking about like weirdest and wildest actors, I'll just exclude maybe there's a lot of child appearances, you know.
Sure.
Watching a boy Tuvok fall off a cliff, I don't know if he really qualifies as a weirdest or wildest, you know, alternate actor.
Well, that was the centerpiece of what I was going to do this whole episode.
I thought it was. That's why I'm cutting you off before you even get a chance here. But I think there's a lot of potential to have some fun to kind of delve into kind of the history of these alternate actors, what they brought to the table here. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if the ideas we have about what else could have worked in this situation. I think this will be a lot of fun here.
Right, yeah. I mean, I can't say I'm totally up to speed on my 1990s character actors who would be working in syndicated TV, but let's give it a shot.
Your GeoCities page would say otherwise, Cam, but okay.
Angel Fire. Okay. Angel Fire.
Fair enough. Let's kick it off with somebody who I think is going to be in the Star Trek mind, the zeitgeist, as you might say,
right.
Going forward. One, Patrick Stewart originated the role of Jean-Luc Picard.
Mm-hmm.
In this situation, we have a lot of options to kind of look at who maybe played him in different ways, eras. Let's kick it off with one, Marcus Nash.
Right.
He played Ensign Picard in Tapestry. What did he bring to the role for you, Cam, other than gurgling noises as blood came pouring out of his gut, or his heart, I should say.
Well, that's... No, you pretty much summed it up right there. Yeah. It's funny. He's actually attending this year's Star Trek Las Vegas convention. And that's the photo on the page advertising his appearance. And it was fresh in my mind when we came up with this episode idea. And yep, that's about it.
Well, that's just it. Like, could we have pulled it off with like one Patrick Stewart just wearing a toupee? Or did you need like a younger man?
Well, the thing about Patrick Stewart, there's a couple of things that are difficult, and this doesn't apply to necessarily like everyone on this list that we're going to talk about, all these different actors, but like it's very difficult to cast someone who looks like Patrick Stewart.
Sure.
Like it's like it just doesn't exist. And Patrick Stewart, you know, he was in his 40s when he's doing TNG. He somehow looks older and wiser. It's very tough to cast a young person who reflects that wisdom that we bring to just the image of Picard. And I don't think they did it with this guy.
I know, but you know what?
And it is the more rambunctious Picard, but I mean, it doesn't feel like Picard.
You know, on that note, the last thing I'll say about Marcus Nash, though, is if he is doing an in-costume, you know, Nausicaan dagger through the heart sort of like photo op, I am totally down for that.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
But, you know, you bring up a very good point here, and I wonder if that conundrum that you brought up there was kind of solved with Tom Hardy playing, I guess, technically Cadet Picard in a photograph of Jean-Luc back in Nemesis. But
maybe... I was thinking more him as Bane because it really reflected the pumped up Picard of the movies.
Yeah, First Contact, those guns on him there. But like, I think it's fair for us to maybe talk about Shinzon, who's essentially like a Picard clone.
Yeah.
Tom Hardy, a very young Tom Hardy.
Yeah. I think 25 or something.
Yeah, and it's kind of more like a gaunt Tim Hardy compared with the man that we kind of know is kind of this pumped up dude.
It's so funny because Tom Hardy's about my height, and yet like when I see Tom Hardy, he's a towering like monster.
He's ripped.
Yeah.
Yeah. But in this situation, he really kind of pulls off that gravitas that you need from a Patrick Stewart kind of character, and he's doing it at like as a child, pretty much. Like, he is a young man in this role. But they did put some prosthetics on him. You know, like, he had, like, a nose piece. I believe he might have had a chin piece, but don't quote me on that. So they are doing some physical changes to this guy.
Do you think, though, he's supposed to look that much like Picard? Because you have the Romulan DNA in there. I could never quite figure out if they were trying to make it look like a one-to-one of, like, this is what young Picard looked like versus, like... Yes, there's a lot of Picard DNA there, but it's also mixed with the facial features of like a Romulan.
Well, I'll say the fact that they used Tom Hardy to depict the Cadet Picard in that photo.
That's true.
I would say he's meant to do that. But there is this retcon, this weird retconning in that you look at Marcus Nash, he's got a full head of hair.
Sure.
But in that cadet photo of Picard, he's old Baldy, as they like to call him on the show.
That is what Hollywood studios do when they don't think a lot of their audience. Because they're like, we can't show that photo if he has hair, because then the audiences won't understand that that's Picard.
They just be like kind of like scratching their butts like bamboons or something like that. They'd just be very confused. You
Short of a baby photo, the studio's going to stress. Because, I mean, you know, Jean-Luc Picard is going to have hair, at least up into his 20s, I would imagine.
Yeah. How do you think Tom Hardy acquitted himself?
It's a weird performance. What I expect from Tom Hardy. It's very memorable. And I think, and I'm going to say this for, I think, you know, at least a number of the actors who I highlighted on my list, and that there are a lot of them are victims of their material. I think if you give Tom Hardy the assignment and are like, we want you to really...
With Keiko O'Brien?
Exactly. If you give him that episode. No, but I mean, if you give him the assignment of... replicating like a Picard performance, I think Tom Hardy can do it. But working with this, you know, the director who wasn't a Star Trek fan, under circumstances where they're making a movie that really doesn't often feel very TNG in spirit, you kind of get what you get. And I don't think Tom Hardy would have come to the table with, you know, the idea of, yeah, I want to do this kind of weird performance. Although, knowing Tom Hardy, he may actually have had that idea, judging from Venom.
Could you imagine if that's how he played Shinzon?
it's like Picard, like, flapping around in a lobster tank.
That's the exact moment I was going to go to as
well. It's the only moment in Venom worth talking about.
That's true.
But
well, that and Woody Harrelson's hair.
Well, that too.
That's Beverly Crusher.
But yeah, like, I think Tom Hardy does as much as he can to create a performance, but also, like, Picard feels off-model. The Jean-Luc feels off-model in those movies. It's like, I would have loved to have seen this type of story in a TNG two-parter. I don't know that necessarily Tom Hardy would have done a season 7 TNG two-parter, but, like, imagine him working in the kind of the Berman factory with a little more direction as to how to do a Picard performance.
He only had a few scenes going toe-to-toe with Patrick Stewart. I think he did a very good job, and it's actually a unique situation with this alternate actor sort of deal that we're going to be talking about, where the alternate actor actually gets to interact with the, you know, prime actor, so to speak. There are maybe... one other prominent incident of this, but we can get to that later on.
Do you think people would have held Shinzon in higher regard if he felt a little more like Picard?
Like from a the perspective of maybe Picard in like Who Watches the Watchers, for example?
Yeah.
Would he have worked as an antagonist in that situation?
Well, you're doing the dark mirror image. You have the Picard who's brought up to be more aggressive or violent. But, you know, like he just doesn't really feel like Picard when he walks on screen. He feels like... kind of a strange, kind of creepy performance.
He feels like Patrick Stewart going dark in a role, but I know what you're saying, not necessarily Picard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just wonder if he nailed that and maybe Stuart Baird, the director, had been interested in tapping into that a little more and actually cared about the show, then you might get more of something like, I know they want to do a Wrath of Khan, but more of like the fans being won over more by that villain performance maybe a little more like they were with Wrath of Khan.
Okay, so Cam, I think what you're really getting at here is that you would have preferred that David Tristan Birkin, who played Picard in Rascals, was, you know, allowed to age up into the role for Nemesis.
They never answered my letters, Tyler. I know. They never did. I didn't want him to age up. I wanted him at that age.
Yeah.
Playing Shinzon. Like 11-year-old Shinzon.
Yeah. Yeah, gouging himself. Yeah, with a spear.
Pulling himself along. Like, yeah. Hug me.
Look, I think it's kind of tough to put any kid in a role like this. I thought he was fine. Like,
yeah.
What else could you really hope for when you're putting him in like a child in like again, a Patrick Stewart role?
We come back to the central problem I kind of have with Picard recasting, and that, like, I think this kid's pretty solid. I think Rascals, you know, was a fun episode. We'll probably talk about some of the other casting in that episode later on. But like, this kid is given an impossible assignment. You're like, what, 10 is he? Maybe 11?
Maybe 12.
Yeah, somewhere in there. Can you please like try and play a young Patrick Stewart? I can't even imagine what a young Patrick Stewart is.
Look, he did the Picard maneuver.
Yeah.
You know, he tugged on his uniform.
Yeah.
I thought he was fine.
I think he's totally, you know, he totally works in the episode.
Yeah.
So, and that's an episode that shouldn't work.
Yeah.
That should be the worst episode ever, and it's not. It's really fun.
It might be one of my guilty pleasure episodes.
Yeah.
So, Cam, why don't we move on to kind of another unique situation here that maybe I kind of alluded to, but let's talk about the Star Trek Discovery era. I think most notably we have maybe Pike being recast yet again here, but this is a role originated by Jeffrey Hunter.
Mm-hmm.
And he was next played by Sean Kenny in the Menagerie two-parter.
Yeah.
There's another couple of actors, very prominent actors, that took on the role there. But how do you think Sean Kenny embodies the role that we knew of one Pike afterwards?
It's like looking in a mirror.
Yeah. Not to take anything away from Sean Kenny, but
yeah.
Could anybody have done this role?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not a lot there. There's not even emoting, really.
Yeah.
And you can't even say, like, you know, you see a movie like, say, the Diving Bell and the Butterfly, where I know that's a movie that is on the tip of the tongues of all Star Trek fans, but it's like, you know, you have the actor who's playing, in that case, someone who has, like, locked-in syndrome. They're, like, locked inside their body. And you're getting a performance just through, like, blinking of an eye and things like that. But, like, Sean Kinney in a 1966 or 67 production is not getting these sorts of opportunities to really stretch his acting muscles or do something really interesting.
Yeah.
It definitely feels like they threw prosthetics on him to make him look like Jeffrey Hunter, sat him in the chair, and were like, good to go.
That said, you have had your photo taken with Sean Kenny before.
No, I actually didn't. I met him and got an autograph photo.
Okay.
Yeah, I have a little bit of a rule that whenever I do Star Trek, you know, meet and greets or whatever at conventions, if there are characters who wore heavy prosthetics, I prefer to do autograph photos because it looks like the actor, right?
Sure.
Whereas if I show someone my photo op with an actor who looks nothing like that,
like Armin Shimmerman.
Yeah, sure. Then they're like, okay, I don't know who that is.
Okay, so, fair enough.
Yeah.
Why don't we jump over Bruce Greenwood, a bit of a revelation here.
Great.
Taking on the Pike role. Like, I thought for a long time, how are you ever going to top, you know, the Bruce Greenwood portrayal of one Christopher Pike here? Does it feel like kind of the Pike that we know from The Cage, or is this kind of a different sort of mentor character, an Obi-Wan Kenobi of sorts, just in its own regard?
Right, yeah, it definitely does. I think he was even supposed to be pretty much the Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Yeah.
But, yeah, like, I think this was a genius recasting, and not just a genius recasting, a genius rewriting of Pike. And I think we actually enter an interesting avenue here, which is, I would argue, with Bruce Greenwood and where we're going to go onwards, you're getting actors giving better portrayals of Pike than the original.
Mm.
And I don't think that's the case for almost any other character. There might be a couple we touch on, but not many, especially not major characters like this. And I mean, Bruce Greenwood brings this, it's a little bit fatherly, but it has a little bit of a tougher edge to it, too. I always think of that scene in the bar where he really is giving Kirk like a lot of attitude back about putting him in his place and saying, you know, you can do better than this.
Doesn't he feel kind of like Red Foreman, a softer Red Foreman from that 70s show?
Yeah.
You know,
he's going to put his foot up his ass.
Speaking of Star Trek actors, one Kurtwood Smith, you know, I just feel like he's kind of got like this tough love sort of attitude. He sees potential in one Chris Pine playing up, you know, one Captain Kirk. And I just think it's kind of a really solid performance. And, you know, it sucks when he dies in Into Darkness.
Yeah, it's a lame death. I mean, I like the moment of Spock feeling the death, you know, as he goes through it. But it's not the greatest finale for that character. But there's something about Bruce Greenwood's performance. And I think you see it in Patrick Stewart's performance, in some of the other great, you know, Star Trek performances. There's this real sense of, like, this real inspirational nature to their portrayal, where when you see these actors playing these roles, you feel the spirit of Star Trek. And Bruce Greenwood has it. Yeah. And I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is on the page. I don't know what the directors tell the actor to make them tap into this so well. But you see it and you know it when it's happening.
Isn't Bruce Greenwood kind of made for period pieces? Like, he's got that kind of like, sort of like, it could be any year possible, and he is existing as a contemporary character within that year.
Yeah. Well, he's played like every member of like the JFK administration at this point.
That's true.
Yeah. He definitely works well in those sorts of eras. Yeah.
Okay. The other one that we need to talk about here is one Anson Mount playing him, who, again, I said that Bruce Greenwood was a revelation. Anson Mount, I think you and I were both blown away with season two's portrayal, and that happened very early on for us watching Discovery.
Wright and Brother. I was like stunned at how good he was, because Bruce Greenwood really did set a gold standard, I felt, for that character. And I really didn't expect them to top it. And especially when you kind of are going from the movie version to, you know, the CBS All Access streaming version, you're like, well, it's probably going to be not quite necessarily the resources and care put into it that you maybe saw in those movies. And I was wrong. I was completely wrong. I thought that Anson Mount was absolutely amazing. And he really had the benefit of surprise with me. I knew Bruce Greenwood was a great actor. But I mean, I was ignorant to what Anson Mount had done before. I'd seen him in a couple things that I don't remember, but, you know, like, that was it. And all I really knew from him at that point was that he'd done that Marvel show. Was it The Inhumans that had tanked? And it's like, oh, that guy. Okay, yeah, this feels like a step down from Bruce Greenwood. And then he becomes probably my favorite Pike of them all.
Yeah, but it's interesting that, like, you mentioned that Marvel show. Mm-hmm. He was also the lead on Hell on Wheels.
A show I never saw.
He had been anchoring TV series for a while. Like, he was, even though we weren't super familiar with that, we should have realized, well, if this is a guy who's anchoring shows, there must be a certain gravitas that he's bringing with it. That said, it didn't stop you from investing big dollars into a photo opportunity.
That's right.
A character you'd never seen before.
And I believe you're doing it this year.
Yeah. Well, you got a year ahead of me in on that before we were all blown away by one Pike. You and our friend of the podcast, Jesse Okendo, you guys paid how much? What, 90 bucks US to do this? I think Scott Hardy and me, we will be doing the same in about 3-4 weeks' time with one Anson Mount. We just love that portrayal. And I'm with you. He's my favorite Pike. Maybe we should be doing this as we go through like multiple actors and characters. Anson Mount, he takes it away for me as a alternate Pike. What about Picard for you? Who do you think is the definitive alternate Picard?
I guess just by process of elimination, I kind of have to end up on Tom Hardy. There's not a lot of competition. I can have issues with how Shin Zan is portrayed or how, you know, the, sort of the angle they took on their Picard representation. But the level of performance you're getting out of Tom Hardy trumps the other actors by quite a margin.
Well, see, I'm just basing it all on his cadet photo.
That too.
There you go.
The photo outacts actually some of the other actors.
Yeah. So I agree, Tom Hardy there. So Pike is an interesting one here. He's originally portrayed in the original series first by one Jeffrey Hunter, followed by Sean Kenny, then Bruce Greenwood in the Kelvinverse, and then Anson Mount in Discovery. We have a very similar situation with one Spock. Everybody knows Leonard Nimoy.
Everyone has played Spock.
Everyone, yeah. Leonard Nimoy originally portrays him. And look, there's, I think, 14 different actors that have portrayed him at one point, and I guess we can blame Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, for most of that. But the prime ones, though, we have, you know, Zach Quinto, we have Ethan Peck, and there's a couple child actors. Jacob Kogan from the Kelvinverse played young Spock there.
Yeah, Liam Hughes played him in Discovery.
And that's right. And
you also actually have Billy Simpson did the voice of Spock in the episode Yesteryear, the animated episode. And I am a big fan of that episode. I think he brings a lot of emotion to that performance.
Yeah, and there's like a throngs of other guys that played him. I don't know, like a Stephen Michael Manley, for example, played him as like 17-year-old Spock in The Search for Spock. So
yeah,
the list goes on.
Funny story about The Search for Spock, though. You know, you think of the scenario, all these actors, because there's what, like four of them played Spock in that movie. They're getting auditions. They're like, this movie's going to be called The Search for Spock, and I'm playing like Spock at age 17. Like, oh my God, this is a big deal. And then they get there and they're like, can you please groan? It's a lot of like Spocks that are completely just don't even have lines or just like moaning. And it's like, huh, this is not the showcase I thought. I thought I'd get like 10 minutes of doing Spock on screen.
So maybe if we eliminate the more peripheral...
No, they're my favorites.
...alt Spocks. You know, I think that Jacob Kogan acquitted himself quite well playing the young Spock there. You mentioned the yesteryear version doing the voice there. Those were both, you know, good performances. But maybe kind of the prime candidates that we can kind of debate about, though, is Zach Quinto versus Ethan Peck here.
Yeah.
I think maybe you're almost handing an actor an impossible task at this point with both these actors.
Is it, though? Here's the question. Is it easier to recast Spock than it is like a Picard? It seems like it might be. Judging from the success ratio.
Do you think because of maybe just the distinct look that this character has? Give him a bowl cut. Give him some pointy ears.
That could be part of it. When you have someone in makeup, it's easier to at least get a like a physical representation that looks somewhat on point.
Yeah.
It's tough to make a Patrick Stewart. And then, like, you know, we're going to talk, I'm sure, about Kirk. But, like, it's easier to find someone that looks like a young William Shatner, I think. But there's something about the Spock recasting that it seems like they're able to find physical types that fit. It's can they find the actor for the role? And I think they've had really good luck finding two actors who bring a lot to the table and can actually have that level of gravitas you want from a Spock performance.
We've debated a little bit about, you know, kind of the Ethan Peck versus Zach Quinto performances. And I think we're on the same page in that Zach Quinto's version of Spock almost seems... Look, it's the Kelvinverse. He's a more emotionally unraveled Spock. And we can kind of wash it away because of the alt timeline, but it's an interesting performance, and he brings a certain gravitas with him, and he's got the opportunity that we've seen, like, say, Patrick Stewart and Tom Hardy have, but he gets to go toe-to-toe with his predecessor, Leonard Nimoy, as well, in a very nice scene. I think that Zach Quinto really acquits himself very, very well in his introduction as this alt Spock here.
Yeah, I like him a lot. I think he took a while to win me over. I definitely felt... Because I was so steeped in the original series at that point, he didn't feel like the Spock I knew.
Do you think Beyond was maybe the best portrayal of Spock that we've seen that from Zach Quinto?
I think he has moments in Into Darkness that are very strong, too. Okay. I actually think he feels between 2009 and Into Darkness like he kind of nailed it down a little more.
Is it when he's doing kung fu on the garbage truck
in
San Francisco?
That's exactly what I was thinking about. Yeah. I'm like, that's the Nimoy I know and love.
Okay.
But yeah, like it feels like that's the point where he finds maybe a little more of the humor and humanity of Spock that I feel like was missing a little bit in 2009.
Yeah.
But he is an actor who was given a very unenviable task and I think became iconic in his own right to fans, which is difficult because I think you could have easily had an actor who looked like Spock and pulled off a decent imitation of Nimoy, and he didn't do that. And I think it worked.
Do you hear hardcore fans railing against Zachary Quinto at this point?
Like, no.
I don't.
No.
You know. So maybe let's talk a little about Ethan Peck. You know, another seemingly impossible task. I think he benefits a lot, honestly, from having like his first 6-7 episodes just in that beard.
Yeah.
If you give him a distinct look and there's a reason for that, you can kind of...
Divorce yourself a bit from that's not Nimoy or that's not Zach Quinto.
It's not as jarring.
It was also tough because he was also coming so close to Zach Quinto. Like, when you have the Anson Mount after Bruce Greenwood, I don't know that necessarily people have as ingrained an idea of who Pike is before Anson Mount comes back as Pike, right? Like, Bruce Greenwood is a supporting role in those movies, whereas, like, Spock is a headliner. And to get an audience over the Nimoy hurdle and accept the Zach Quinto for 3 films and then be like, and here's another new Spock, is difficult. And I think that Ethan Peck, the beard, I think, adds a lot to making it feel a little different, but Ethan Peck just blew me away. He feels so on point again that it's kind of eerie, and I actually think he channels more of the Nimoy qualities than Zach Quinto does, at least in a natural sense. Like, I feel like Quinto affects them, whereas I feel like they come naturally out of Ethan Peck.
See, I was going to make the argument in that maybe he's obligated to do so. Maybe he has less room for his own interpretation just because of the era that he's portraying him. And look, it's 10 years before we meet Spock, well, minus the cage, you know, for example, but he's a looser sort of Spock, and you can understand as to why that is. And, you know, that said, the one disconcerting thing, though, is like when we see him without the beard and he's in the blue uniform.
Yeah.
That threw me, though. I was just like, huh.
Yeah, it's a little male model Spock.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
He looked good scruffier.
I liked him better with a beard, personally. Yeah. So.
Well, I mean, we're going to get to see him in a short trek coming up soon. So we never really got a lot of material with an unbearded Spock played yep. by Peck. And I'm really excited to see if I can kind of be won over by that look.
Here's hoping that we'll get a Mirror Universe version with a goatee and we can bask in his facial hair once again.
So who is your favorite of the Spocks?
Huh. Okay. I have to go with Zachary Quinto. I think just being the first guy mm-hmm. to have to jump into that role, I think that's tough. And he made it his own. He made it mm-hmm. a character that, look, you can quibble with, you know, the differences between the Prime versus Kelvin verse portrayals. He made it its own. It's a compelling character. I think it would have been great if we could have had Zach Quinto back, even though I love Ethan Peck in this role, and I thought he did a phenomenal job, too.
I love Zach Quinto's performance a lot. I love what he brought to those movies, but I got to go with Ethan Peck. Okay. Ethan Peck is the one that really drew emotional responses from me. I could watch the Zach Quinto version and think, like, that's really awesome. And he does, you know, I should, to be fair, it is like a very strong emotional moment when his mother has just died and he's in the turbo lift with Uhura. Like, that is a fantastic moment. But there's something about the Ethan Peck one that just won me over that extra touch more. A lot of his scenes with Burnham just were, it was a consistently strong series of like dramatically powerful moments that really did win me over in a big way.
If you add it all up, he's probably on screen for almost as much time as Zach Quinto has at this point. So they're kind of going toe-to-toe right now. Mm-hmm, so that's interesting.
And the thing about Zach Quinto is like as a movie star and also a film producer too, like he's a busy guy and he's not someone who's going to, I feel like, assign himself that sort of Spock role and really carry it long-term. Whereas I feel like Ethan Peck might be more of that option, and I'm okay with that. And I think he had a tougher job to kind of win me over and get me to accept that.
Yeah.
But if he wants to run with the Spock title for as long as he wants, great. I think he has it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
No qualms for me here.
No.
Why don't we dive into Sarek and Amanda here?
Yeah.
Because, look, very similar to what we've been speaking about with the two preceding characters, but originally portrayed in the original series, then we got to see them in the Kelvinverse. Now we're seeing them again in the Discovery era. So we have Sarek, originally played by Mark Leonard, then Ben Cross in the Kelvinverse, and James Frayne in the Discovery era. And of course, Amanda Grayson, originated by Jane Wyatt in Journey to Babel, played by one Winona Ryder in the Kelvinverse, and Mia Kirshner mm-hmm. in the new era.
Also, Majel Barrett in the animated series.
That's interesting, too, yeah. So, from your perspective, though, Ben Cross versus James Frayne. Like, I know when we started watching Discovery, you were kind of poo-pooing on James Frayne, though. But I was more in his corner early on.
I mean, the thing about James Frayne is, he did not win me over quickly. But he gets such fantastic stuff to do. I actually loved Ben Cross's portrayal of Sarek. I really think with more material, he could have been absolutely amazing. But his Sarek didn't really get that much to do. And so you kind of got that one movie, you got a few scenes, and that was about it.
Yeah.
I would have loved to have seen what Ben Cross could have done going forward if he'd had more time. Because he's a really good actor. You know, he's in like Chariots of Fire. He's really fantastic.
Yeah, but with me, when I was watching James Frayne as Sarek, like it felt more like, you know, Sarek being realized again on screen. Whereas when I saw Ben Cross, it didn't really seem to be that Mark Leonard sort of portrayal at all. Like I
really, I feel like with Ben Cross,
I didn't pick up any Mark Leonard at all.
I feel like with Ben Cross, he taps more into that aloof sense that you saw in the Mark Leonard one, where the scenes with him and Spock, for example, that kind of really icy aloofness that you can feel that, like, why there's such a distance between the two of them and why they don't connect. Whereas, like, James Frayne, by virtue of the fact we're seeing him spend all his time with Burnham, a character he connects with, he's able to win us over because he's presented in a much more likable way. And so, I don't know. Like, I really admire what Ben Cross is doing, but I think if you're going to ask an audience, which one do you like more? I mean, James Frayne really has the advantage because you're like, he seems awesome.
Sure, yeah.
He seems like a pretty great guy.
Well, you know,
maybe some questionable parenting decisions over his time, but, you know, he seems like he's willing to change.
Well, there's another kind of other side of the parentage that we can talk about here, but with Mia Kirshner versus Winona Ryder, I don't know if Majel Barrett's going to take it away with her voiceover work, you know, necessarily, but they're both interesting portrayals of Amanda, and you kind of feel for them. They both have that emotional connection that with audiences that I think is very important, and you were alluding to just a second ago with regards to the Sarek deal. With Winona Ryder, I heard the casting, and I went, huh, isn't she like the same age as like...
It's kind of weird stunt casting.
Yeah. But I thought she was great.
Yeah, she's really solid. I think the issue with her, though, is a little bit of what Ben Cross faced, too, which is you're playing the icon of these characters. Like, Winona Ryder doesn't have a lot of time. She has a few early scenes, and then she's killed off. And so I don't know that I get a lot of the three dimensions of Amanda that even Jay and Wyatt got to do through the course of the original series in her episode as well as the movies. So I don't know.
Would you call Jane Wyatt iconic?
I think so. Okay. I think you probably would.
I wouldn't, but there you go.
That's cold, Obi-Wan.
I'm just being honest, though.
Yeah.
Mia Kirshner, though, it's another situation. She just keeps popping up in all these random episodes. If you jumped on IMDb, you'd probably be surprised by how many of these Discovery episodes she's in.
Well, she now holds probably the most screen time ever for Amanda.
Yeah, for sure. So it's interesting how she, throughout our reviews of the episodes of Discovery, you and I kept saying, this must be like the most put upon woman in the world. Like, just what a saint having to deal with all these dudes, these very emotionally aloof dudes in this one household, you know? Mm-hmm. And she brought some humanity. And you could also understand, I guess, her motivation for wanting to keep this family together. And, you know, she brought some great humanity or volcanity to it all as well.
She really has a huge advantage in that this feels like the first time the writers actively cared about developing the, you know, Amanda character. And yeah, like, she's probably the most multidimensional version, and she's a version that I understand.
Yeah.
The Spock version, you know, the original Spock, I should say, Jane Wyatt, like, I really like the actress. I think she does a lot. But again, you're not getting the level of insight into her inner life that you get with Mia Kirshner. So, like, Mia Kirshner, in a way, for me, is probably the best Amanda by virtue of the fact she's a character I understand. And I always want, if it's a supporting character I'm going to see pop up again and again, I want to be able to understand them and what their inner life is like. Because, let's face it, Amanda has been around for over 50 years, this character, and it's not until really 2018, 2019 that we understand her.
No, I'm totally there with you. So if I had to give the live long and prosper sign to these actors, I would give it to one James Frain and one Mia Kirshner myself.
I think I would give it to James Frain in the sense, like, I think over time he's really built a very, very strong character. But I do think, like, to me, he's not, like, huge head and shoulders above Ben Cross. I just think he has a huge advantage over Ben Cross. Whereas, like, for me, like, Mia Kirshner really does run away with it. I don't think there's a real comparison between her and Winona Ryder.
Okay, so, Cam, I think we took care of a lot of maybe the big names, some of the very prominent examples that we have to delve into. Maybe we can have a little bit of fun with it moving forward. We'll go a little bit quicker. But Cam, tell me, give me an alternate actor here and a character that you thought was weird, wacky, wild, interesting, what have you.
Okay, well, I feel like we have to talk about him. It's not necessarily one who's weird and wacky, but we have to talk about William Shatner, you know, the Captain Kirk being recast in the Kelvin verse. And you have Chris Pine. And I think there was a lot of questions whether you could recast this. And I want to kind of tie this to a larger discussion, the Kelvin verse, because we talked about the Kelvin verse recently. And we gave our thoughts on each of the actors, but I'm just curious.
We're not going to tackle every single one.
No, I'm just curious, you know, kind of starting from Kirk, like, who do you think were the strongest ones? Who are the ones that really did win you over in a way that maybe stood a little above the others?
I think Pine did a phenomenal job of kind of capturing the spirit of Kirk.
Mm-hmm. Was it out of the gate?
Well.
Or did it take some time for you?
It took a little time. Like, yeah. I wasn't a huge fan of him in Into Darkness. I think it was more of kind of the Mandela effect version of Kirk, where it's like the pop culture version of Kirk that really didn't exist in this series. That's what he ended up doing in Into Darkness. But, you know, early out of the gate, you know, just watching him do some bar fights or what have you, or him being kind of the bookworm back at the Academy and just doing his own thing. He wasn't doing an impression of Shatner, which I think would have been the most nightmarish decision possible that an actor could have made.
Yeah.
I dig what Pine was doing throughout these movies. And look, by the time you get to Beyond, he's doing the whole mortality questions that we see so often in Star Trek. And I buy it.
I love him in Beyond. Yeah. Like, I feel like he is really becoming the Captain Kirk I know and love from the original series at that point. You know, you have those first two as sort of your origin story establishing who Kirk is. But when I watch Beyond, especially in those early sections where he's doing the voiceover, I'm just blown away.
Yeah.
It really does feel like Kirk.
From there, you know, I'll give it to Carl Urban. We talked about this recently. I think he did well with, like, it's not quite verging on an impersonation of one DeForest Kelly, but he's...
But it's probably the closest of the rest of the cast.
Yeah. But that said, I don't quite get the Simon Pegg casting. You and I talked about that as well. And I guess it's weird, wild, and wacky, but doesn't quite work for me, though.
It's the most outside the box casting choice of the group.
Yeah. But the other people, I don't necessarily think that John Cho is the Spock or the Sulu that I know and remember, but
he's definitely not the Spock you know and remember.
No, that's true. But I think Zoe Saldana, though,
she is, I think, outside of Kirk, I think she might be my favorite.
She might be, yes,
because I like that she's not... That's definitely not an impression of Nichelle Nichols.
Yeah,
it feels like an entirely new character, and kind of like with the Amanda situation, it really does feel like the writer saying this time, let's do Uhura to the best of our ability and really write a dynamic character. And Zoe Saldana, I mean, you see in Guardians, you see in Avatar, she's able to just work in these genre projects and bring so much life to the characters, and I think she really walks out of those movies as headliners, not just in billing and in terms of screen time, but as one of the big iconic characters to come out of the Kelvinverse.
Okay, so Cam, if we have to choose best alt actor between the versions of Kirk, do you give it to Chris Pine or Sandra Smith from Turnabout Intruder?
Oh, well, or what about young Jimmy Bennett from the opening of 2009? My name is Tiberius Kirk.
You tell me, between those three.
I think Chris Pine walks away with it.
No Sandra Smith love?
Plenty. I think she thinks she's pretty good in that episode. In fact, I'm going to go better than pretty good. I think she's really good
at channeling. She had a tough job. And we commended, I guess, one William Shatner for just going for it.
Sure.
But, like, he did a very stereotypical, yes, this is what I think of women in the 1960s, well, sort of portrayal.
He's doing a camp performance where she's doing a real performance.
Yeah.
And I think she's fantastic in the episode. You know, you can't blame the actor for the material they're given. The episode has not held up well at all, but I think it's worth watching. I think the reason that episode still holds value is because of her performance.
Still to this day, how do you justify women not being allowed to command starships in the 23rd century?
I don't know.
What were they smoking now?
I would
in that
love
writer's
to
room?
Know, because Roddenberry had checked out at that point.
Yeah.
He's not involved with the day-to-day on that show. I wonder if he would have ever written that, if that's just a Freiberger era. Or, I don't remember who wrote that episode, but I wonder if that was more from that point of view. I'd be curious if Roddenberry ever would have written that.
I like trying to justify weird things into my own head canon.
Mm-hmm.
I can't make this one work.
No, it doesn't work.
This one seems like a non-canon episode, even though it is canon. It just, I can't wrap
it
my
is
head.
Canon, but at the same time, I think they've completely retconned that anyway, that there were captains before, because there's the captain in Enterprise.
Yeah, Erica Hernandez.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. So anyway, why don't we jump over, I'll do a fun one here. Let's talk about the Doctor. I thought Jerry Ryan playing the Doctor in Body and Soul.
Yeah.
That was amazing.
You got to listen to everyone out there. Listen to our Body Swap episode as well. We talk more about that one. But
it's a problematic sort of story setup in which the Doctor's...
Not as problematic as Turnabout Intruder.
Sure. Oh, for sure. Yeah. But, like, it's the Doctor taking over Seven's body so he can experience physical pleasures such as eating and getting drunk, and she feels violated, and as she should. But Jerry Ryan is absolutely killing it, picking up on Robert Picardo's over-exaggerated mannerisms. And I think this might be my favorite comedic episode of Voyager after Tinker Tanner, Dr. Spy.
Yeah, it's a very, very... It might be my favorite, actually. It's a really strong episode. Although, you know, maybe Favorite Son is my favorite comedic episode of Star Trek Voyager.
Intentionally comedic.
It's hilarious.
Okay.
And it features an alternate Harry Kim actor briefly. But
is it like a baby Harry Kim?
It's a young kid.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I don't even remember why, but I stumbled across it in my research. I'm like, okay, I guess.
Sure.
But no, I mean, this episode is a lot of fun. And Jerry Ryan, Sandra Smith, similar scenario here where you're getting this actress giving this really meaty performance. In this case, Jerry Ryan gets a great episode to actually show it off in. And again, bringing a lot, channeling this character, but not in a way that's like full caricature. You feel the integrity of the character is intact, channeled through them.
So, Cam, I'll throw it back to you. Is there another actor that pops out, or an alternate actor that pops out to you, taking on like an iconic role?
Yeah, I've got one. Let's hop series here again. And, you know, when you're thinking in the future of what an older Jake Sisko might look like. I think we all think Tony Todd.
As Sir Auchlofton still does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tony Todd was such a weird casting choice for a Sir Auchlofton stand-in. And yet, he is absolutely astonishing in that episode, The Visitor.
Okay, the thing that did throw me off, though, the first time I watched this episode is I see him on screen, and all I can think is, that is Kern's voice. That is the man who plays Kern. He has such a distinct voice.
Yeah.
It's the only thing that threw me off. Is Tony Todd looking at Sir Auchlofton's performance, though, and trying to turn that into a Jake Sisko of his own? Or is he just looking at this very, very meaty role on the page and just going there with it?
I don't think he's trying to echo Sir Auchlofton's performance. At least I don't get that sense.
I didn't get that either.
This is an alternate future where, obviously, Sisko's been erased through an accident. He's dealing with a character that doesn't really represent where Jake is on the series. This is a character who's gone through a lot of life struggles and has been tormented by the loss of his dad. And you see that, you know, Tony Todd is able to chew into this role in a way that is, like, fierce and magnetic and just breaks your heart time and time again. And this is the type of performance that could be really, really brutal to sit through, where it's an actor in heavy, elderly prosthetics. And we can all think of many a bad movies where actors were heavy, elderly prosthetics.
Yeah.
And essentially narrating their story to a random character. And it all works. And yet, there are so many Oscar bait dramas of the 90s that pull this crap that drive me out of my mind.
Yeah.
But this episode is just so emotional and powerful.
Yeah, we've got to give it to Tony Todd. Like, I'm sorry, but Thomas Hobson, who played young Jake Sisko in Emissary during the Battle of Bull 359.
Yeah.
Maybe one day you'll be at Tony Todd levels.
Yeah, exactly.
I can only hope. Cam, if we're talking about, you know, the House of Moog, we got to tackle this one. Let's go to TNG, starting with TNG, and tackle Alexander Rodchenko.
Oh, boy.
As originated by toddler John Stewart.
Yep.
He's the original. But for me, Brian Bonsall is the kind of definitive, you know, Alexander for me. He's the one that
he's the one people know as, like, memes and all that sort of stuff.
Just he's in the cowboy gear.
Yeah.
You know, he's in the classroom with, you know, imaginary friend where he's getting clay thrown at his head.
He's in the mud baths in Cost of Living.
Yeah. So you have a couple other actors that are playing him. Mark Warden plays teenage Alexander in Sons and Daughters on Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
We also have James Sloyan. He's playing an alt elderly version of Alexander, relatively older version in Rightful Heir, where he's coming from the future. Oh, sorry, no, it's not Rightful Heir.
No, it's Firstborn.
Firstborn, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm getting my Worf goes into Klingon politics episodes mixed up here. For me, Mark Warden, he seemed like a different character to me. It wasn't quite the Alexander that I knew.
It definitely did not feel like Alexander to me at all.
Yeah.
And so, like, I can watch that episode and, well, I really don't like that subplot. Or I guess that's the A plot of that episode, but it's not very good.
Yeah. It just makes Worf look like a jerk.
It gives you some sort of finality to the character of Alexander. And he does show up again in You Are Cordially Invited, right? Yeah. So you do get at least some sort of writing off of that character, but
I do wish he popped up a couple more times just for Worf to acknowledge that he has, like, a son that he should be more involved with.
Maybe
you know?
In season 7 they should have done that in DS9.
That just would have been one more appearance, and I would have been okay with
one of the movies. He's like the star.
Look, Paramount is looking to reboot Star Trek somehow, so...
Yeah.
James Sloyan, I guess I could buy him as Alexander just because they tell me that it is. I don't know. It's really... He just, again, he seems like a totally different character, I mean, like, divorced from one Brian Bonsall.
Yeah, like, James Sloyan plays Dr. Mora on DS9.
Yeah.
He's far better in other characters.
Yes. So are we giving it to Brian Bonsall as the best alternate Alexander?
Again, like,
he's just so iconic, right?
He's iconic, but also, like, I know people like to take shots at Alexander. I don't really like the character either. But, like, this is a very young kid, and what is he being directed to do on set?
Yeah,
and,
I know.
You know, there is the old adage. I'm sure said it on this podcast before, where they say, you know, the key to good child performance is a really strong director and a co-star who knows how to get a performance out of them. And I just don't know that this was the case with this kid, especially in syndicated TV where it's on a, you know, they get time is money and they're kind of speeding through. I don't know that he was getting the best coaching throughout.
Well, it's also a very limited amount of time that they have with him because yes. they first have to apply the makeup. And then with child actors, you are not allowed to, you know, put them through these 14-hour days or anything like that. You've got a couple hours tops, but you have to minus putting on the makeup and taking off all the makeup. He's on set for maybe 2 or 3 hours at a time.
Yeah.
Every day. Like, yeah. it's not enough to coach them through everything they need from, say, a director to get the best performance.
I'm very sympathetic to child actors because they're...
Well, you are one.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, I was one of the three ninjas. You know, like...
Rocky?
Tum Tum.
How on earth do we actually know the names of the three ninjas, Cam?
I have no idea. But, you know, I was in Mega Mountain. But I mean, like, the thing is, like...
With Lonnie Anderson?
Wasn't Hulk Hogan in that one, too?
I forget.
I digress.
I can't believe I knew that Lonnie Anderson was in a Three Ninjas movie.
But, yeah, like, I don't really like a lot of the kid performances in Star Trek shows. You know, I didn't like the kid in the 2009 as Kirk, either. But again, this is a young actor. What material are they being given to do?
Yeah.
You give a child actor that Alexander role in Cost of Living, they are not walking out winners.
I know.
I don't care who it is. If it's like a prime era young, like Haley Joel Osment, when he's just like, you know, post Sixth Sense, he's not making that episode magic.
What about Jonathan Lipnicki?
Oh, from Little Vampire.
Or I was thinking mostly Jerry Maguire, but yeah.
No, Little Vampire.
Okay, sure.
He's like isn't he like a bodybuilder now?
Is he?
I think he is, yeah.
Okay.
Very strange.
Yeah, well,
anyways.
Anyway, I don't get my subscription to Men's Health magazine anymore. So, Cam, what's next up for you?
I think there's one we have to talk about. It's not necessarily the most interesting, but that's...
great. Let's talk about it.
Benedict Cumberbatch's Khan.
Okay.
Because that's a hugely iconic role.
Yeah.
And we know that they were looking for a lot of actors. Benicio Del Toro was, I think
it was a front runner.
He was like in talks.
Yeah.
And was it, there was another actor too, Damien Bashir maybe?
Okay.
I think was in talks as well.
I think, yeah, that rings some bells.
But ultimately, Cumberbatch gets it. And this is a case where it's like, I don't know if I blame Benedict Cumberbatch. I blame the people that cast him in the sense of like, this is not a good fit.
Well, A, it is completely whitewashing
yes.
a role of a South Asian man.
Yes.
Number one. And then B, his portrayal just seems completely divorced from the Khan that we know from Space Seed and The Wrath of Khan. I just like I can't connect the two in my head, and it's just it's just bizarre creative choice on the part of say JJ and company at this point. And I give them a lot more leeway than I think most hardcore Star Trek fans do. But in this situation, I was just like, huh? Like
yeah.
I could not really suspend my disbelief.
When you see Ricardo Montalban, especially in Space Seed, and that's the era that he is playing. There is a real, like, charisma to that character, like a vigor, a forcefulness. Those aren't qualities I expect from Benedict Cumberbatch. That's not what he brings to the table. That's not his skill set.
It's mostly his pectorals that I'm there for, Benedict.
But, like, he feels more like more of a scheming, kind of sneaky villain character. And that's not what you expect from a Khan in Space Heat.
He's almost presented as, like, a potential ally hero.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I guess they both have that in common, sort of.
Yeah.
I don't know, but it just seemed like two different characters to me.
Like, I feel like Montalban's Khan is a character who, like, wears the crown
proudly.
Did you
say Montalban?
Well, are you the first person that's coined that?
I can't believe no one said Montalban before.
It's very strange.
Wow, okay.
But, like, that's a character
Doctor Strange?
That's a character who wears the crown proudly. Whereas, I don't picture... The Benedict Cumberbatch Khan walking around like, look at me, I'm a leader.
Yeah.
He's a guy who feels more like an Iago type, who's like stabbing you in the back, you know?
Yeah.
It's just weird casting. I don't blame him, but just bad casting.
Okay, Cam, why don't we go to something a little bit more interesting than that? William A. Wallace, he portrayed Wesley Crusher in...
bang on.
Yeah.
Hiding cue, right?
I'm just saying he captures Will Wheaton's voice in an amazing way. It sounds exactly like Will Wheaton's voice. I don't know how. This actor just has these chops to make him sound exactly like Will Wheaton. And this is a 25-year-old man sounding like a 13-year-old boy.
It's funny. When we do these podcasts, I am always looking for every opportunity I can to somehow have a chance to put a weird character into our artwork for an episode. You know, I finally got my chance when we did Alien Leaders to do my Vedic Barile.
Yeah.
This is the time I get my opportunity to throw in adult Wesley Crusher.
William A. Wallace.
Yeah, like William A. Wallace is getting his shot at the subspace art because of this episode.
I love it, Cam. Okay, that said, who's next on your list?
While we're talking about kid actors, I think this is a good segue for me to talk about Michelle Krzyzewski, who played Molly O'Brien in Time's Orphan on Deep Space Nine, where we got to see an alternate universe Molly O'Brien who's been raised after disappearing into like a cave.
Yeah.
And she's 18 and feral. What did you think of this performance of Molly O'Brien?
Okay, look, it is tainted by me not liking this episode quite a bit. And we've had like listeners write in and say, well, you guys don't have kids. If you had kids, you would appreciate it on a different level.
Right.
Fine. I can only appreciate it on the level that I'm capable of. And I just didn't... Her performance kind of made me feel like uncomfortable. Not because of her performance, I guess, but what this character has come to. I felt for the parents and like, what are you supposed to do in this situation? And yeah, it is heart-wrenching that you have to, you know, throw her back to this portal and let her go on her own. I don't know. Where are you at with this performance, Cam?
I think this is actually like a really well acted episode. I totally understand why people don't like it. Like, it makes complete sense. It's one that I actually feel like I get more out of it than most do. Like, I actually find the performances in it so strong that I'm kind of drawn into it, even though I can acknowledge it's not necessarily the best written Deep Space Nine episode around.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's in some ways how some people might feel about Dark Page, an episode that maybe they get something more out of that I do not like sitting through that episode at all. I really don't enjoy it. But Time's Orphan, I actually think she's really good as this feral Molly O'Brien who's gone through this life of just brutality and trauma and has become this really closed off being that they're trying to connect with.
Yeah, look, so if the actress is going to be at Vegas and Hana Hatai is going to be there too, I'll totally do a double photo op with
them. That would
be
so amazing.
Yeah, yeah. I would have fun with that.
Yeah, for sure.
More like a joke. Okay, so Cam, another interesting one here. Curzon Dax, as originated by the legendary Franco and Smith in Emissary, laying on that slab, getting the symbiont
what a performance.
Ripped out of his gut there. Yeah. Rene Bergeron got to play him in Facets.
Yeah.
This, like, I just think Rene Bergeron is just one of the most unsung characters in all of Star Trek here, and he just brought kind of the weird stuff that's going on with his character where you find out that he's actually in love with Jadzia this whole time.
Mm-hmm.
But he just brings this kind of nuance to it where you feel for this guy despite... You know how maybe a little icky that is, you know, but the fact is he is this legendary character who has this charisma. Rene Bergeron, who's playing the gruff Odo for all these years, you buy that he is kind of the jolly drunk that everybody wants to party with and play, you know, Rock de Gino, or not play Rock de Gino, that's what you drink.
Right.
Is it not Dabo? What's the Ferengi card game? Tongo.
Tongo, yeah.
Tongo, yeah. So it's like... I buy Rene Bergeron in this like charisma ball sort of role versus the gruff sort of closed off Odo character. Like, just think about the range that this guy's got.
Curzon Dax is a character. I really enjoyed his performance in this episode, so that's not to take anything away from his performance. It's a character I almost wonder was almost better off never being seen because of all the stories we hear about Curzon Dax and Sisko's fond remembrances of him and how much he informs Jadzia's journey. It's something I almost wonder if it was too much to ever expect deliver in terms of this charisma bomb character.
Yeah.
And there's obviously a little...
I know what you're saying.
There's a darker side to the Curzon we see in this episode. I think that's where the drama comes from and the sadness of that character. I think it totally works, but... It's a character I wonder if you were ever going to be able to deliver. You've built him up so much.
So if you were to recast him with any of the other DS9 actors...
I was going to say Wilford Brimley.
Okay, thank you. Wow. who do you think could give a different sort of take other than Rene Bergeron? Like, I think Rene Bergeron...
I think he was probably the best choice.
Yeah,
I don't have any issue with Rene Bergeron, but I mean... It's really just the fundamental idea of like, or question of whether you could ever do that character. I just think he did the best you could ever do. I think his performance is fantastic. I don't have any issues with the performance.
Okay, well, I'll give you my answer then. I think that maybe if it was possible to get Mark Alimo as Golda Kot, he's involved with this, you know, Trill ritual. I could kind of follow him as Curzon Dax. I think
sure.
Mark Alimo could have pulled that off.
Yeah, him or the guy that played Shakar.
Charisma balls. Yeah. Cam, what's next on your list here?
Let's talk about a recent one, and that's Melissa George as Vina, the classic character played by Susan Oliver in The Cage and the Menagerie. I never dreamed when we started watching Star Trek Discovery, you know, episode one, I never dreamed at some point I'd be seeing Vina pop up. And not only was it not just a, you know, single cameo homage kind of moment, it was a emotional connected scene between her and Pike talking about their relationship and what it meant to the two of them and really paving the way for Pike's big sort of finale as a character going back to Talos.
Do you want to see her back, or do you think this is kind of... Yeah, like as much as maybe we both liked her portrayal here, I just wonder if it's going to take away from this performance if we keep going back to that well. I think you can be one and done, and that makes it kind of perfect right there.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
I thought she was great. I've been following her since she was on Alias back in the day.
Right.
She was in, I think, Dark City as well. Like, I just, it's weird that she never really kind of broke through the way that I thought she had the potential to do.
It's all agents, you know, connections.
Yeah.
It's the way it is for a lot of actors.
Yeah, but look, if we get to experience her on, say, Star Trek Discovery, I guess I can't complain, you know.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I'm down with that. Another one that I want to bring up here, you know, Ishka, originally played by Andrea Martin, and Cecily Adams ended up taking over the role. I'll say this, I had no idea jumping from, you know, the next time I saw Ishka, you know, aka Mookie, that it was another actress playing it. And
yeah,
look, she does have the benefit of being caked in makeup. I get it. But I think the fact is that she really kind of honored what Andrea Martin had done before. And I think I love that continuity that they kept going with the character.
Yeah, I think there was always the potential for the Ferengi stories to kind of tip over into like grotesque, kind of uncomfortable comedy, like of just not being fun to sit through.
Yeah.
Because
well, we did get that with Profit and Lace.
Well, that's a great example of a terrible one. But there is this really heightened, weird comedy to them that when you have a lot of actors in really strange prosthetics could really wear on you. And to me, it never really happens outside of that one you mentioned. But both these actresses' performance as Moogie brings like an integrity and dignity to this character in a really outlandish scenario.
Yeah.
And the evolution of her journey through Ferenginar and Ferengi society is really compelling, you know, coming from a character who's in comedy episodes for the most part.
So, Cam, I only have one more on my list here. I'll throw it back to you, and if there's any that you want to get out of the way as we finish up here,
yeah.
I'll let you do that. But the last one here on my list is one Greg Grunberg playing Finnegan in Star Trek Beyond.
This is so weird.
Does this count?
No.
Is this actually Finnegan?
I think this is so stupid.
Is it just a dumb inside joke that we're all on the receiving end of, or what?
Yeah.
For those that don't know, okay, so Shore Leave, we have kind of the, was it like an Android version of Finnegan or something that appeared in Shore Leave?
I think just a projection.
Bruce Mars originated the role of Finnegan, who is Kirk's rival back at the Academy. He was taunting him throughout Shore Leave. And then we get like this nothing character do a couple lines of exposition at Space Station Yorktan in Star Trek Beyond. And then the producers reveal that was Finnegan?
Yeah.
They're like, okay.
He doesn't look anything like Finnegan whatsoever.
And he's not Irish. He doesn't have an Irish accent anymore.
Yeah.
I don't know what to make of this other than like they're just messing with us.
It's just like a weird in-joke.
Yeah.
It's sometimes you see comic book movies where they'll name a character after a well-known like character in the comics. Like there is actually in the new Spider-Man movie, Far From Home, which I really enjoyed.
Yeah, you and I both saw it together.
I it
with
really
fallen
good.
Co-host Benjamin Yong. We got him out. I think all of us that one saw it really liked it.
Yeah, I'll say best Spider-Man since the first two Raimi movies in
I'll
my
say
eyes.
Best Spider-Man since Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
Well, I'm holding that one aside because it's such a unique animal. Live action, I should have said. I should have prefaced that with live action. But like there's a character in that named Dimitri. And, like, Dimitri is the name of a Spider-Man villain. So a lot of fans were like, uh-oh, they're throwing in Chameleon. And that wasn't the case. It was just a way to kind of throw everyone off the scent.
I was completely oblivious.
You were oblivious, but fans were definitely locked onto that one
early. I just thought
he
was a really badass bus driver.
But, yes, I feel like that's kind of what the case was with this Finnegan. It's more fun to throw it out there as a name mention that fans go like, oh, my God, is that the Finnegan? And anyone else is like, Huh?
Did any fan go, oh my God, it's the Finnegan?
Maybe.
I don't know if that got it.
Maybe when they saw the credits. Maybe.
Was he named Finnegan in the credits?
Yeah, he was.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so maybe then they were like, oh my God, he was Finnegan.
Okay.
So maybe.
Okay. Kim, you tell me what's on your list here.
I think there's one we have to talk about, and that is Savick, who, Kirstie Alley originates the character. And you get Robin Curtis.
Yeah.
And I always feel really bad for Robin Curtis because I feel like when Kirstie Alley was gone, they were like, okay, this character now has nothing to do.
Yeah, but then why bring her back, you know?
And I don't know. Like,
it is a weird decision.
She has a fairly prominent role in Star Trek III, but it also feels like there's no dimension to the character at that point.
I know.
And in 4, she's just left behind on Vulcan. And I just finished a book called The 50-Year Voyage, the first book, where they talk about the shooting of each of the movies and the series and everything. And they talk about how originally Savick was going to be pregnant with Spock's child, which is why she was staying behind. And they just cut all that. So it's like taking extra stuff away from Robin Curtis. She already had very little to do. They just took that extra little bit out.
So Robin Curtis, as well as the producers, have said that if they had gone ahead with the original plan of having Savick be the Valeris character in Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, that it would have poisoned the character.
Yeah.
I would have been okay with it. It would have it would have brought the character full circle. We would have gotten this really interesting arc with her.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's kind of better than where we left her off, which was the planet Vulcan, which is, I think, where the captain of the USS Discovery is still waiting around for the ship to come by so he or she can take command. Good luck there.
But speaking of the movies, I want to just talk about 2 from First Contact, because you have both the Borg Queen, who's, you know, as Alice Krieger there, is, you know, recast as Susanna Thompson in Voyager, as well as First Contact also brings us back up to speed with Zefram Cochrane, James Cromwell, who is replacing Glenn Corbett, who's in the TOS episode Metamorphosis. And these two become huge icons out of that movie. And what do you think of the actors who, you know, in the case of First Contact, it's James Cromwell playing the established character, and then you get Susanna Thompson doing the Borg Queen later.
I say First Contact, Uber Alles. Like, both those actors portraying those characters, I think, are the definitive version of those characters. I think Susanna Thompson was given a tough job, but I think she was really great as the Borg Queen. Like, I think it was an almost impossible task, and she's doing kind of Zach Quinto level sort of like magic there with what she's doing. And it's a distinct Borg Queen, and one that I can kind of, you know, do the headcanon with as well. And it works for me. I think the Borg Queen is a character that can keep popping up in every single iteration of Star Trek from here to infinity going forward, just because of how they've established that. So what are your takes on these different portrayals? And I'll maybe ask you this. Is that from Cochrane we meet in First Contact almost an entirely different character from the one that we meet in Metamorphosis?
Well, they look the same, Tyler. they feel radically different. Yeah. The Glenn Corbett character feels very like straight arrow, NASA astronaut type guy of that era. I mean,
he's John Glenn.
Yeah, he does feel like that very all-American type astronaut type. Whereas Zefram Cochrane in First Contact's kind of like this partying drunk Yahoo guy. Yeah. I mean, I think it works.
Do you want to do the Ooby Dooby?
I feel like Zefram Cochrane in the film works for that film spectacularly well. And I love his character journey. Like, there's a lot of emotion brought to it by James Cromwell. I love the arc of that character. I'm not like the world's biggest First Contact fan, but his arc is really the most winning, I think, section of the movie for me. Like, I really feel for that character. And I love seeing him pop up in Enterprise down the road. And feeling like the progression of that character from where he is in First Contact to seeing off, you know, so Archer and crew.
At that point, can you almost imagine that is kind of him becoming the Glenn Corbett version of that character who is going to be regenerated into more of a youthful fella?
Okay. I mean, I love the Glenn Corbett performance as well, but it's a different thing. And as for Susanna Thompson, I would be very curious. We've seen some characters, even like Khan, where it feels like when they're doing the Into Darkness, they don't know how to write a Khan character necessarily. I wonder if the Borg Queen is a character who is somewhat, in a way, easier to write. Because I feel like there's a real consistency to how everyone has written that character. Yeah. And the actresses have benefited, both of them, by playing, even though it's different actresses doing their own unique takes, either case feels like the Borg Queen.
She's ominous she is resolute in mm-hmm. her worldview. Mm-hmm. I think you can get some good nuggets of dialogue from somebody like that. And if you're envisioning Alice Krieger in the role and you find a good actress that can kind of emulate that to a certain degree, but give them their own twist, I think if you have Alice Krieger inspiring you,
yeah.
I think that's very, very helpful for the writers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And one I just wanted to close off with, I think,
yeah.
You know, I think you and I might talk a little later about Rainn Wilson as Harry Mudd. I think that might come a little later down the road.
Okay.
But I want to just throw out, because we haven't talked about Enterprise really at all. And just to, I want to mention Shane Sweet and Adam Taylor Gordon, who play Trip in the episode Similitude, which is the episode where they make the clone of Trip.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, we have a very young actor and we have sort of a teen actor. I thought they did a fantastic job in establishing this tragic version of Trip that we watch this very grim one-hour story of what's going to happen to this clone. And this is a really fantastic episode.
How much of it is the young version of Trip really carrying on his shoulders, I ask you? I think that this
episode, the youngest one? Not a lot.
Yeah, but I just think that maybe this episode maybe kind of it's really Connor Trinneer carrying
definitely
most of it.
I agree, but I do think especially the teen one, the Adam Taylor Gordon, I think you really get a okay. real sense of who, like you feel the Trip character in his performance, which I would not say for a lot of the other kid performances.
Sure.
And yeah, so, and quickly, we set it up way earlier. Favorite Rascals cast member?
Okay. I have to, well, other than Picard?
Yes.
I guess Ro.
Yeah, that was going to be mine as well. And that's Megan Parlin.
Yeah.
Yeah, who okay. I think is really great as a young Ro.
I thought the whole Miles and Keiko stuff was so uncomfortable to watch.
Yeah.
They must have been able to find, they could have come up with some other character that could have, you know, been the fourth kid, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know what they're trying to do with the Miles and Keiko stuff, but it was just, it was weird.
Yeah.
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 So.
But it's a fun episode nonetheless.
It's, look, you got the Ferengis being goofballs. It's a silly episode. I'm curious what the IMDb score is for this one, though. I don't know if it's a fan favorite or if it's more derided, but you and I, we both think it's kind of a fun one-off sort of adventure.
My shot in the dark at 7.6.
There you go.
We'll see if I'm right.
you're probably not going to be off by more than 1 point.
That's right.
So
we'll see.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Look, we left a lot on the table. Let us know some of your favorite alternate actors that filled in for Star Trek icons. We'd love to hear yours. Okay, Tyler, what are we doing next time?
Oh, Cam, as you alluded to, we are going to be talking a little bit more about Rainn Wilson moving forward. We are talking about the reinvention of Harry Mudd. Recall when season one of Discovery was coming up and there's news that Rainn Wilson had been cast as Harry Mudd, and all you heard me was bellyaching about how we're going to have the return of essentially kind of this sex trafficker. They're going to try to make him like a rascally rogue. I did not want to see this. And Rainn Wilson completely won me over. And I don't find the character nearly as problematic in this era that maybe he becomes later on. But it's actually going to be a fun episode in which we can dive into the way that the character has changed and developed and kind of the opportunities that we see moving forward as well.
And maybe a little bit of how the social norms of the time have rewritten the character as
yeah.
well.
Yeah,
I think that's going to be really interesting to talk about. Okay, so you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in Vadia Potenza, played 13-year-old Spock in Search for Spock.
Wow.
Smith.
Wow. You can find me at Reportin, that's R-E-P-O as in Ruby Dooby. R-T-O-N.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed. Been strutting, 'cause now you know how to do the ooby dooby, baby. Let's go, ooby dooby, 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 dooby doo, one, one, one. Transfer complete.